Dr. Shivram Kalyanakrishnan is an associate professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay. His research interests include artificial intelligence and machine learning, spanning topics such as sequential decision making, multi-agent learning, multi-armed bandits, and humanoid robotics. He received PhD in computer science from the University of Texas at Austin. He was a research scientist at Yahoo Labs, Bangalore, and an Inspire faculty fellow at the Indian Institute of Science, Bangalore. His contributions to remote soccer have received 2 Best Student Paper Awards at the annual RoboCup competitions. Professor Kalyanakrishnan was also a member of the first study panel of the 100-year study on artificial intelligence, AI 100, which in 2016 released its report titled Artificial Intelligence and Life in 2030. He has been awarded Inspire Faculty Fellowship by the Government of India in 2013. He was listed among AI's 10 to watch list published by IEEE Intelligence System in January 2016. He has been awarded with Professor Kirti Ramamirtham Award for Creative Research for the year 2016 at IIT Bombay. Now may I request Professor Kalyanakrishnan to kindly deliver his talk.
Good, thank you very much. Very kind words. Just give me 1 minute to share my screen.
Thank you, sir. I have made you a presenter, sir.
Yeah. So just tell me if you're able to see the slides in full screen.
Yes, sir. We are able to see your slides, sir.
Okay. So let me get started. So I want to begin by letting you know that I'm incredibly honored to be talking to you today. I was told that there are probably a few thousands of officers from the services, from the Navy, listening in today. So it's because you men and women do your job that the rest of us, right, can take our lives for granted and do whatever else we are doing. So really, it's my honor to be talking to you today. And I'm glad that what I've been working on, right, my expertise has some bearing on the theme of your workshop, and I can help in some way. So I took some time to think about what really I should get across, try to communicate to you today. I had a lot of options. So I have sometimes a presentation which is all applications and very high level, but I've consciously chosen to drill down a little bit into technical detail. Okay, so if there are a few thousands of you listening today, my guess is most of you will end up being users of this technology. Right, but maybe there will be a few hundreds who are somewhat interested in what's going on behind the scenes, right? Who have maybe the background and the aptitude to understand the nuts and bolts, and maybe a few tens out of those hundreds who are actually able to follow up by doing it. Okay, so I've therefore decided to give you a little bit of technical detail. I hope that it will be useful for you. And what I'm going to be talking about is supervised learning. So supervised learning is maybe the most common form of machine learning that we encounter. Okay, you'll see very shortly that I'm giving you some examples that you will directly associate with. But the point, the agenda really is to tell you about a couple of algorithms for solving the supervised learning problem, how they are designed, how they work, etc. Okay, so this is the outline for the talk. We will start by defining the supervised learning problem, and then spend our time understanding two algorithms. One is called the perceptron algorithm. The other is neural networks. These are both approaches for solving the supervised learning problem. And thereafter, I'll just conclude with the summary. Okay, so let's get started and get started with a few examples. Okay, so imagine that there is a bank. And over time, the bank has collected data about loans that it has given out to different people. Okay. So it might have a table that has as its columns the amount of the loan, how long was the duration, the person who was given the loan, what was their annual income and age, in which sector were they employed, etc. But also, I mean, did the loan get paid back or was it defaulted, right? So a bank is very interested in knowing whether a loan is going to come back, right, or it's just going to get defaulted. So what the bank would like to do based on this data, right, is to be able to predict. A new loan application has come in, right, for which we know what is the loan amount, duration, income, age, employment sector, and we have to ask, will it get paid back or will it not? So based on the historical data, can we make a prediction for a loan that we are thinking about disbursing right now? Stock trading, right? There might be a financial company, a trading company that has enough past data about how the stock market has behaved. Okay, opening and closing prices for a certain duration of time, right? Other important things like what was the news that was published on a particular day, which can explain whether the stock price is going up or not. But based on all of this information, presumably what the company will want to do is to get an estimate of tomorrow's stock price, right? Because if you're able to predict that, then based on that, you can buy or sell and make a profit. It's one thing knowing what happened in the past, but the idea is to make that knowledge, right, usable for predicting the future. Yet another example, in fact, because I think I joined in the last 5 minutes of the previous talk, I realized there was something to do about predictive maintenance. So this is what I'm mentioning here. So imagine there's a factory that is collecting data from sensors on its machines. Okay, it's manufacturing something. It's got various gauges to measure. And it also knows historically when machine failure happened. Right? So using that data, can it now come up with a model that can anticipate imminent failure, right? Can we see that this particular pressure gauge has been showing that the pressure of this particular valve is has come down, okay, for over the last 1 week? So can we therefore say, well, this valve is likely to fail, please go ahead and change it, right? But the idea is you should be able to do this ahead of time before the failure actually happens. So the question is, these are all like different applications that different parties have to solve. Is there something common to all of these, right? What is it that the bank should do, the trading firm should do, and the industrial unit should do? We see that in all these cases, what they would have to do is to build a predictive model. You process historical data and use it to make a prediction for what you're encountering now in the present or in the future. Let's take a pictorial view, okay? So imagine that this is the bank, and we actually managed to draw on a picture, right, on a two-dimensional surface, the data that the bank has. Of course, the bank had collected like 5 or 6 different attributes from each loan. So let's just say that the two attributes are X1 and X2. Okay, there might be anything. There might be age or employment sector or amount of the loan or something like that. But let's abstractly just say we're looking at two of these attributes. We know from historical data that this loan that we gave out, right, which had an X1 value so much and an X2 value so much, that was returned to us. That was a plus. This was also a plus. This was also a plus. But then there were also these other loans which were defaulted, right? So all of those, based on their X1 and X2 values, we can call a minus. And now the question is, if you're given a new point, right, this is the new loan application coming in, you want to be able to say, is this a plus or a minus? But now think about it, right? If you are looking at this picture and I ask you, is that point a plus or a minus? I guess most of us are going to say that's a minus, okay? But on what basis? What is the mathematics? What is the process going on in our minds to say that that's a minus? So we've done something like this, maybe implicitly, right? We have drawn a line to separate the positives from the negatives. And anything to one side of the line, we would have called a positive. And anything to the other side, we would have called a negative, okay? Now, think about it. It doesn't need human intuition to do this. We can actually do this exact same process completely mathematically. Okay, and that is what is the topic of my presentation. So a little bit abstractly, the input to this supervised learning problem is a data set. Okay, let's call the data set D. So D is of the point of the form X, Y. Let's say there are N data points, 1 through N. Each data point is of the form X, Y. Okay, so X itself is what's called a vector of features. So an X here would be a single loan, okay? So the features would be the amount of the loan, the age of the person, the employment sector of the person. So those are all the elements of X, and the corresponding Y is a label, okay? So Y is sometimes called the supervision, and that's why this is called supervised learning. And in this case, right, that would be either a plus or a minus or whatever convention we adopt. The idea is, given this data set, we come up with a model. Now, on the previous figure, the model that we came up with was a straight line. Okay, it could be a straight line, it could be something else. But the data is processed by the supervised learning algorithm to produce a model. Now that we have a model, we can use the model to make a prediction for a new data point. right? Maybe you get a value of X. It might be in your data set. It might not be in your data set. But the idea is, if you pass that as an input to your model, right, the model will be able to make the right prediction, which you can use, right? If you know ahead of time, is this loan going to be defaulted or not, you can use that to say, I'm sanctioning the loan or I'm not sanctioning the loan, right? Okay. So what we will look at in sequence is two different algorithms to solve this problem. And I mean, this is where I want to emphasize that I have consciously chosen to give it to you in this level of mathematical detail, because I think it'll be useful at least for some of you. Okay. And really the mathematics you need to know for this is high school mathematics. Okay. Class 11, 12, you need to have the willingness to apply it, right? But I'm not going to apply any sort of very sophisticated state-of-the-art stuff that is beyond your reach. Okay. If you sort of jog back your memory and remember what you did in 10th standard, 12th standard, right? You're going to be using the same ingredients. Okay. So the first approach we are going to look at is called the perceptron algorithm. Remember, the idea is you're given a data set, you want to come up with a model. So let's look at this pictorially. Okay. Let's keep the same two-dimensional picture that we have, which means our data set has two features, x1, x2. Of course, it's got many points, but each point is two-dimensional, and it has two classes, okay, or two labels, which are plus and minus. Mathematically, let's use, let's denote plus as 1 and minus as minus 1, okay? So sometimes we also use 1 and 0, but let's just use 1 and minus 1. It's not a big deal. Okay, so this is what we are given, and what we need to do is to draw that separating line, right? So we will make an assumption in this context that the data is actually linearly separable, okay? And that by a line that is passing through the origin. So what do I mean by this? We are going to make an assumption, and this is a fairly big assumption. It's a non-trivial assumption that actually there is a valid answer to this, okay? There is a model, there is a line that passes through the origin that will actually properly separate the positives from the negatives. All the pluses will be on one side and all the minuses will be on one side. So we will revise this assumption later, but for now we are making that assumption. And now the question therefore is, given this data set, how do we draw that line? Okay, so you and I can use our eyeballs, our intuition, to go just draw that line. But if you're doing this in high dimensional space, right, where our intuition fails, mathematically, how do you go about the problem of coming up with that line that separates the positives from the negatives? So we will call it a line, but if your data is not two dimensional, right, suppose it's higher dimensional, in general, the surface that we're going to draw is called a hyperplane. So in three dimensions, it would actually be a plane. In four, five, six dimensions, it's called a hyperplane. Okay, but in principle, think of it as a line. Okay, so this is the answer. This is the question that the perceptron learning algorithm will answer. To devise our answer, we have to first come up with some basic representation, right? So yes, we are going to draw a line, but how do you represent a line? So you have two-dimensional space. If I say, give me a line, right? I mean, what will you give me? So this is, I think, taking you back to 12th standard, maybe. You can actually represent a line as a vector, okay? So a vector, remember, is something that has, in this case, two components, right? So take a vector W that has a W1 component and a W2 component. So the claim is that we can use this W to represent a line, or in higher dimensions, a hyperplane. So how is that? We will interpret W as follows, okay? So any point in this space is also a vector, right? So this point, for example, is a vector. This point, for example, is a vector. The notation, right? The assumption that we are going to make, the convention will be that if a vector has a positive dot product with W, okay, which means it's got something going in the same direction as W, then we will label it as a positive. If it has a negative dot product with W, right, which means it's kind of facing in the opposite direction, we will assign it a negative minus label. So if you think about it, right, every point that's actually on this dotted line will have a zero dot product with W. Okay, these are exactly the things that are at the boundary. The hope is, if we draw this W correctly, right, we will have everything positive having a positive dot product with W, and everything that's negative having a negative dot product with W. Okay, so this is just by way of saying, this is how we are going to represent our answer. we are going to represent it just as a vector, right? Because using a vector, we can make this prediction by taking the dot product. And the question is, how do you find the W that separates the positives from the negatives? You can see the particular one that I have drawn here is not a satisfying answer, right? Because there are some positives here which have a negative dot product with W, and therefore they'll be classified negative. Similarly, there are some minuses that have a positive dot product. That's not okay. Okay, what we want to find is a W that will assign the correct label to all of these points. It's a reasonable thing to ask because we have assumed that such a W exists, right? Okay, so here's how we do it. This is like 4 or 5 lines of code, right? Which describes an algorithm, the perceptron learning algorithm that will give us the W that we're looking for. Okay, so here's what we do. We start with any arbitrary initial value of W. We can just take any W that we want, maybe the one that I had shown on the figure, or sometimes you just take W to be the zero vector. It's up to you, really. It doesn't matter. However, as long as there are misclassified points, we will update our W. Okay, so suppose there are misclassified points, right? So let's take any arbitrary misclassified point. So suppose there is some point x, y that is being misclassified by the corresponding by the current W. So what does it mean? It means y is positive, but the dot product of x and w is negative, or vice versa. Okay, so we have to do something to change our W to avert this situation, right? So what do? We just do the following update. We set W to be, that is the new W to be the old W plus yx. Okay, so y is going to be plus or minus 1. X is the point that is being misclassified, right? So this is literally all we're doing. So think about it. If x is positive, if x has a positive dot product, but y is negative, right? So we're going to do then w goes to w minus x. If it's the other way around, we'll go to w goes to w plus x. Okay, so the actual rule here, it might not be totally intuitive to you right away. I'll actually show you a illustration of this, but that's all, right? So based on this misclassified point, we went and changed W. Now again, we go and ask, is W still misclassifying? If it is, again, you find some misclassified point and make the update. You keep doing this as long as there are any misclassified points. If you come out of this while loop, right, it means that there are no misclassified points left. So as long as there's a misclassified point, you'll be making these tweaks. But once you've classified everything correctly, you will come out, and at that point, you can return the W that you currently have. Okay, so this is really all there is to it. This is like a full-fledged algorithm. It looks only 3 or 4 lines, but there's very sort of nice mathematical properties that this algorithm has. So let me first show you the working of this algorithm with an example. Okay. So let's say that when we started, we initialized with this W. Okay, this W is pointing sort of down and right, and it's making a lot of mistakes, right? In fact, think about it, it's making 100% mistakes. Everything that's positive, it's actually going to call negative. Everything that's negative, it's going to call a positive. Doesn't matter. The whole idea is that based on the data, we should refine the W so that eventually we get it to the correct configuration. So let's take an arbitrary misclassified point. So maybe we take this point. Okay, so what's going on with this point? This point has a y value which is negative, right? So what we should do is we should do w becomes w minus x. Okay, so if you remember your vectors, if x looks like this, then minus x is what you get by just reflecting it about the origin. And if you want to add w and minus x, this is where you'll get the answer. Okay, so this is the vector that will look like W minus X. And this is going to be our new W. Okay, so if this is our new W, here's how the picture looks right now. We seem to me have made some progress, right? We're getting some answers correct. Of course, we're still making some mistakes, but we've made some progress from how bad we were originally. Do the same thing. Okay, find another misclassified point. So maybe we take this one here, which is a positive point, and now we have to do W goes to W plus X, okay? So that's what we do. W plus X looks something like this if you do vector addition. And this is how our new W looks. We're still not finished, right? Because there are some minuses being classified as positive. So again, pick a negative point and make the corresponding tweak. Now we are done, okay? So by a series of these mathematical operations, we have now found a W that actually separates all the positives from the negatives, right? So this can be returned as the answer. Now, the key question is this algorithm that we described, right? Will it always converge, like conclude and find an answer, a satisfying solution? So the good thing is, yes, as long as there is actually a satisfying solution. So this is why we made the assumption that the points were linearly separable by a line passing through the origin. If the points had not been linearly separable, right? Suppose there was no legitimate answer, then it's unfair to expect the algorithm to find you a legitimate answer. It's just not there. But if it is there, this algorithm will find it. And using this illustration of the perceptron learning algorithm, I hope I have, convinced you, or at least to some extent made you think that we did something fairly elegant and simple, okay? And that's actually provably solving the problem for us. And this is actually the nature of a lot of AI and machine learning on the inside, okay? The methods that we have, many of them are intuitive, but they have very solid mathematical backing. So what I'm not doing here is actually the formal proof, right, that this method will give us the right answer. But the method itself is fairly intuitive. Why was this called perceptron? Okay, so perceptron is an odd sounding name, right? You say electron and neutron and things like that. Is it somehow related to atomic particles? It's not. So the perceptron is maybe 50, 60 years old. Okay, so the person who came up with this whole idea, Frank Rosenblatt, he actually built this device in hardware. Okay, so he built a circuit in which the inputs would be the dimensions of the data points, right, the x1 through xd. That would get dot producted with w. Okay, so you'll do w1 times x1 plus w2 times x2, etc. One small departure from what we did on the previous slide is it's sometimes also the convention to add what is called a bias term. Okay, so not only do you do w dot x, to that you add b being either a positive or a negative number. And having done that, you ask, is that greater than zero or is that less than zero? Okay, so this, if we go back to our figure, would be the equivalent of allowing ourselves to draw a line that doesn't pass through the origin. Okay, if you have a bias that is different from zero, then you'll allow yourself to draw a line that sort of passes, it need not coincide with the origin. Okay, so that gives us a little bit more flexibility. But then you ask, is w dot x plus b greater than zero or less than zero, right? Depending on that, you compute your answer to be either, earlier we had said minus one or one, but for now, let's just say the answer is zero or one. Okay, so formally what we're doing is we are taking w dot x dot product, adding b, and looking at the sign of this quantity. Okay, so sine function is a function that will give a value of zero if its input is less than zero. It'll give a value of one if its input is greater than or equal to zero. Okay, so we pass this dot product plus bias through the sine function, and that is the prediction that we're going to make. Okay, so that's what I've written down over here. And because this was happening in hardware, right, maybe they wanted like a fancy name and therefore they called it a perceptron. But here's the key point to note, right? The point to note is that right, maybe what we did in our algorithm is we had some arbitrary parameters to initialize, right? But then we kept tweaking it so that it classified more and more points correctly, right? So this is a form of learning in the sense that the data tells us how to set our parameters, okay? All right, so that was perceptron. And perceptron leaves a very natural answer, the natural question unanswered. Okay, and that is the question that neural networks will answer. This is what I'm going to go into next. So sometimes I stop for questions, but I think I'll take the approach of maybe finishing up, keeping enough time at the end for questions. So if you have questions, maybe just jot them down and I'll take them towards the end. Okay, but where really are we going? Why are we going from perceptron to neural networks? It is because of that assumption we had made with perceptron that the data was linearly separable, right? But in practice, should we expect data to be linearly separable? No. Okay, I mean, we don't know where this data is coming from. It's not very reasonable to expect that all the positives will be on one side and all the negatives will be on one side, right? So take this picture, for example. This is called the XOR problem. And this was given long back as an example of a simple problem that a perceptron cannot solve, right? You just can't draw a line here that has all the positives on one side and has all the negatives on one side, right? But then we still want to solve problems like this, right? Suppose this is our data set. Can we learn a predictor that is able to make an accurate prediction for this data set, right? Data that is not linearly separable. So that means we need the flexibility to be able to draw something like a curve, right? That sort of pushes positives in first and third quadrant away, and second and fourth quadrant it predicts is minus something like that. A single line, right, won't do the job. So we need something that is non-linear. So how do we do this? Turns out perceptron is actually not such a bad thing after all, if we are willing to be a little bit creative with what we're doing with the perceptron, okay? So let us combine perceptrons in an intelligent way to make this prediction, okay? And by that, what do I mean? Here's what I mean. What we have on this figure is a network of perceptrons. It's not a single perceptron. It's actually got five perceptrons, okay? So what's going on? So our inputs are x1 and x2, okay? I'm just doing this based on the figure. So it's a two-dimensional input. So let us have one perceptron. This is what I'm showing my cursor. It's on the top left, whose input weights are 1, 0, and a bias of 0. Okay, so these blue numbers are the weights on the perceptron, right? So what does that mean? It means the output of this perceptron, okay, which I'm denoting A1, is going to be 1 times x1 plus 0 times x2 plus 0 passed through the sine function. Okay, so if you take a minute to work out what that is, right, it's not paying any attention to x2. Whatever x2 is, it's just getting multiplied by 0 and coming in. It's paying only attention to x1, right? It's basically asking, is the sine of x1 0 or 1, right? So a1 is simply going to be 1 if x1 is positive, it's going to be 0 if x1 is negative. This is because we carefully chose these weights to be 1, 0, and 0. Let's have another perceptron, the one in the left and bottom, whose output is A2. Now, A2 is giving a weight of 1 to X2 and 0 to X1. Okay, and it also has zero bias. So basically, then X2 is calculating what is the sine of A2 is basically the sine of X2. Okay, so A1 is going to be 1 if X1 is positive, 0 otherwise. A2 is going to be 1 if X2 is positive and 0 otherwise, okay? Now comes the sort of interesting part. Nothing should stop us from actually treating A1 and A2, which are the outputs of these two perceptrons, as input to a new set of perceptrons, right? I mean, why should we not do that? There's no reason to just use a single perceptron, right? So let's construct two more perceptrons. So this perceptron here takes as its input A1 and A2, okay, which is what came out from the previous perceptrons. It's giving a weight of 1 to both of these, but it's using a bias, okay? It's using a bias of minus 1.5. So what does it mean? It says it is going to look at the sine of A1 plus A2 minus 1.5. Now, if you think about this, the output B1 of this perceptron will be 1 only if A1 and A2 are both 1, okay? If even one of them is 0, right? Let's say A2 is 0 and A1 is 1, then A1 times 1 plus A2 times 1 will be only 1, okay? And 1 minus 1.5 is minus half. So that can't get through the sine function. So if you want to get through the sine function, you need a plus 1 contribution from both A1 and A2, right? So B1 can be interpreted as the AND, okay? This is like the logical AND of A1 and A2. So you're somewhat familiar with Boolean logic, like treating numbers as zeros and ones and then thinking about AND and OR. So B1 is basically A1 and A2. B2 is constructed similarly. It's putting a minus 1 on both A1 and A2 and then adding half. So if you do this with some sort of eyeballing, you'll figure out that B2 is actually going to output not of A1 and not of A2. Okay, so only if A1 and A2 are both 0 will B2 be 1. If A1 and A2 are, even if one of them is not 0, then B2 will be 0. Okay, and finally, we are taking B1 and B2 as inputs to a new perceptron. we're doing V1 plus V2 minus half, looking at the sign of that and calling that the answer. So that's a proxy for just saying that our output Y, right, is going to be V1 or V2. Okay, so let me just again recap what's going on this slide. There's a fair amount of detail, right? But our inputs are X1 and X2, right, which was there on the previous figure. What we would like is to calculate Y such that Y is, let's go back to the figure, right? We want Y, our prediction, to be positive for things in the first and third quadrant. And we want Y to be negative for things that are, or zero for things in the second and fourth quadrant. So how are we doing that? We are constructing sequence of perceptrons, output from one goes as input to the other. But mathematically, the way we have set up these weights, right, ensures that Y will be V1 or V2. So what does that mean? It means it's going to be true if either A1 and A2, which means things are in the first quadrant, or B1 or not A1 and not A2, which means things are going to be in the second quadrant, right? So again, if you're willing to, I don't know, just take a small leap of faith, right? What this means is that this network of perceptrons actually solves the XOR problem. Okay, this is actually a legitimate answer to a model, right? It's a model that will make the correct prediction. For things that are in the first and third quadrant, it'll output one. For things in the second and fourth quadrant, it'll output zero. So we did this successfully, right? So what is the catch? Why are we not done? Why is XOR a difficult problem? So here's the main thing. It's a maybe subtle point, but it's also an obvious point, right? When we did the perceptron learning algorithm, we set the weights of the perceptron based on the data, right? Remember that we were going through the data. Every time we saw a misclassified point, we went and changed the weights. How did we come up with the weights for this network of perceptrons? I set the weights, right? Manually, I used my knowledge or something like that and came up with these weights. So what we have not seen, right? What we don't have is an automated procedure to say that for this particular problem, make this a 1, make this a minus 1, make this a minus 1.5. I've not given you a data-driven process to set these weights. Is it possible for us to develop such a process? Yes. Okay. It's going to be slightly less successful than maybe what I have done over here. It's got some caveats, but by all means, we can do it. And that's exactly what a neural network does. Okay. So let's get familiar with neural networks. So artificial neural networks or neural networks are the solution to solving these nonlinear problems by composing perceptrons. Not composing perceptrons, but a slight departure from a perceptron that's called an artificial neuron. Okay. Again, this is a matter of nomenclature. You might hear different people calling these things different things, but I am just going to go with the convention that on the left, we have a perceptron, exactly the same thing that you saw earlier. On the right, we have an artificial neuron. So what's the difference between these two things? A very, very slight and subtle difference. Okay, so again, an artificial neuron has all these same inputs multiplied by these weights, a bias. The only difference is earlier, right, the output Y was given by the sine function. It was sine of W dot X plus B. On the right, in the artificial neuron, we are going to use a slightly different function to compute the output. Instead of using sine, we are going to use something called the sigmoid function. Okay, so this here is the Greek letter sigma. Okay, so it's just called the sigmoid function. It could be called other things, right? But it's just called a sigmoid function. And the sigmoid function is defined as 1/1 plus e to the minus x. So don't worry about the definition, but the intuition behind using a sigmoid function instead of the sine function is apparent from this figure. Okay, so what I have done on this figure is I have drawn both the sine function and the sigmoid function. So remember that the sine function will basically give zero as the answer for any input that is negative. And for any input that is positive, right? So if x is to the right of zero, it's going to give plus one as the output. Okay, it's the curve that you see in green. Sigmoid, for all practical purposes, is doing the same, okay? Except it is smooth, okay? So as you make x smaller and smaller and smaller, it's basically going to give zero as the output. And for very large x, it's basically going to give one as the output. However, in between, right, it has like a gradual response. So if x is between minus 4 and 4 or something like that, right, you will genuinely get something that is between 0 and 1, okay? In fact, at x equal to 0, it's going to be exactly half. So why, right, did we go from this sine function to this sigmoid function? For a very crucial, important reason. So that reason is that the sigmoid function is differentiable. Okay. If you see the sine function, right, it's in fact not even continuous. At x equal to 0, right, just to the left of x equal to 0, it takes 0. Just to the right of it, it takes 1. And therefore, there's a discontinuity, right? Not only is it discontinuous, if you actually do differentiation, right, the derivative of this function is going to be 0 for everything, right? And it's going to be undefined at x equal to 0. So that's not okay. So what we want is a function that has a smooth variation, that has a well-defined derivative. And you can see that this sigmoid function actually has it. Okay, you can do d over dx of sigma of x and you'll get something that is not infinity or something like that. Okay, again, this is taking you back to 10th and 12th standard mathematics. If you actually go back there and start, I think you'll understand what I'm saying, but understandably, many of you might have done that 5, 10, 15 years back, might be rusty. So maybe just take me on my word, okay, that if you can, you can actually differentiate the sigma function everywhere. Okay, that's the only difference between perceptron and artificial neuron. We can do the same thing we did with perceptron with artificial neurons. Okay, we can set up like a more complicated network of these artificial neurons. That's called an artificial neural network. Okay, so you, depending on the number of inputs that you have, right, you can maybe here it's four-dimensional, but you can have one perceptron that multiplies this by some weights, another perceptron that multiplies it by another weights, except we are not using perceptron and sine, we are using artificial neuron and sigma. Okay, and you can take the outputs of these things and make it input to another layer. I mean, I've just drawn two hidden layers, but you can draw more hidden layers if you want. Okay, there are some nice properties now. Okay, so the nice property number one, right, is that because these individual units have this sigmoid function, the output y is actually a differentiable function of the input x. Okay, it would not have been had we used perceptrons, but because we are using these sigmoid functions as the activation in these nodes, y is actually a differentiable function of x, and that is very important for us, as we will see on the next slide. That's important thing number one. Important thing number two is that neural networks like this are what are called universal function approximators. So what that means is, whatever input data you give me, right? So we saw XOR problem as an input. It had pluses, some pluses, some minuses. But think of another problem where the pluses and minuses are all mixed up all over, right? It doesn't matter. There will exist an artificial neural network that can actually represent that data set exactly. As long as you have a finite data set, right? You have 10,000 points, million points. Doesn't matter how they are labeled. There will be a neural network that can fit them, that can make the exact prediction on all those data points. Okay. So that's a nice property for a class of models to have. Neural networks do have it. Okay, now comes the important question. Okay, so we have a certain supervised learning problem. We've devised the neural network. How do we come up with the weights, right? How do we find the W's and the B's that actually give us a good mapping? So remember, we were able to do with perceptron, right? We had the perceptron learning algorithm to set the weights. What we've not said yet is how we're setting the weights for a neural network, right? This aspect that there is differentiability is what comes handy, okay? And that is what is exploited by the most classical algorithm for supervised learning using neural networks that is called backpropagation, okay? So let me give you an intuition about backpropagation. So like any supervised learning algorithm, the input to the algorithm is the data set, okay? You have n data points, x1, y1, x2, y2 through xn, yn. Here's what we're going to do. We will start with some initial weights for our neural network, okay? I mean, it's up to you, really, like come up with some numbers for each of your weights. But now we have to go through the data and tweak the weights, right? So how do we do that? We do it based on the following logic. See, for data point R, okay? So R, I'm just using R as an index from 1 to N, right? To talk about the Rth data point. So what we've been told is that the correct label, correct output for the data point is YR, okay? However, based on the current W that we are using as the weights of our neural network, the neural network will make a prediction, right? So let that prediction be PR, Okay, PR will be a function of W. Okay, it'll also be a function of XR, right? But let PR be the prediction that we are making for the Rth data point. That's a function of W, right? Which are the weights of the neural network. So the prediction is something and the true label is something. What we would ideally like is that the prediction be close to the true label, right? So let us see how far away the prediction is from the true label. The standard way of doing that is to look at the difference between these quantities and to make sure that, we are always treating error to be a positive quantity, right? Not a negative quantity. A common practice is to just square this difference. So YR minus PR of W, the whole squared, will always be non-negative. It will be close to zero when? It will be close to zero when YR and PR of W are close together. If they are substantially different, right? Either one is greater or the other is greater, the square will be great, right? So you can think of YR minus PR of W as the whole squared, as the error currently being made by the neural network on the Rth data point, okay? And if you sum this up over all the data points, right? Take a sum of YR minus PR of W, the whole squared, over all your data points, that in essence tells us how well is our current neural network, which has W as parameter, how well is it doing on this data set, right? Is it doing well, is it not doing well? And in fact, that quantity, right? If you call that E of W, is an indication of how much error is being incurred by this particular neural network. So now comes the thing that we have set ourselves to do. The very crucial thing is that E of W, right, is a differentiable function. Okay, you can actually differentiate it with respect to W. Again, the reason we are able to do this is because we are using those differentiable sigmoids inside and not using this discontinuous sine function. Okay. So if we have a differentiable function and we want to find its minimum, right? What we would like is to find a W configuration that has a small value of E of W. The natural thing is to do what is called gradient descent. Okay, this is to tweak the W in the direction that error is decreasing. Okay, so this sort of inverted triangle here, right? That's called the gradient. So gradient is basically the same thing as what you do by getting like what you do as differentiation in like one dimension, right? You know, d by dx of something, right? That's in one dimension. But if you have a multivariate function that you're differentiating, you have to differentiate it sort of in all directions, and that in encapsulation is called the gradient. But basically the idea is the same. What you will do is you will set your new w to be old w minus this small quantity here, which is a step in the direction that w, sort of E of w, is decreasing. Okay, and you can do this until you converge, until like the w is not really changing by too much. Okay, again, to emphasize is the fact that for a given neural network, this gradient, right, can be computed quite easily. It's possible because we are using sigmoids rather than sine function. Great, so that's literally all that we need. The good thing about neural networks is that they will converge, okay? They might not converge to what is called the global optimum, but they will converge to a local optimum, which in practice is often good enough for us. So what do I mean by that? So look at this figure. So what really we are trying to do is find an optimal W for our neural networks, right? Find the weight configuration for our neural networks. So you can start somewhere. So what you're repeatedly doing is you are going in the direction that minimizes E of W. Okay, so what this will guarantee is you will get to a point where in its neighborhood, E of W cannot be made any smaller. Okay, so it might end up being a local minimum like this. On the other hand, had you initialized, let's say, here or here, right, then you will actually end up with the global minimum, okay, which I'm calling here W optimum. But in practice on complex problems, right, you normally don't go to global minimum, you will go to some local minimum. Okay, so that was neural networks. So just to give you a little bit perspective before going to the concluding portion is, in the last 10 years or so, right, this technology has become very, very successful. Okay, we have learned how to train neural networks with tens, like 40, 50 layers. So if you have more layers in a neural network, you can represent very complex nonlinear functions. What we have successfully managed to do is to be able to run backprop on those and train those neural networks. So this is only possible because we have large amounts of data, It's also possible because we have much better computers, right? A lot of this training happens on GPUs, okay, graphical processing units. So of course, those advances in technology have helped, but fundamentally, right, the fact that we have been able to train much better neural networks is the reason a lot of modern AI is successful. Okay, neural networks find very wide deployment in computer vision applications, in speech, natural language processing applications. So the last 10 years, if you've seen like an uptick of AI, right? Why has AI entered our lives? To a large extent, it's because we've understood how to solve neural networks, which have a large number of layers. Okay, so now let me finish up. So now that you've heard a little bit about supervised learning, right? I just want to tell you that, maybe it should sort of ring a bell as you go through your daily life. Okay, there are so many applications that we don't even like think about which are using this technology. Okay, so I've just put a couple of these on this slide. So you got to go to draw money from an ATM, let us say, right? So you put in your card, you type your PIN number and say, I want to draw 5,000 rupees, enter. It takes some time for the machine to come back and dispense that cash. So what do you think is happening in that time? The request is actually sent to the bank or the server or whatever it is. There, an assessment is made. Is this a genuine transaction or is this a fraudulent transaction? Okay. And only if it is assessed to be a genuine transaction is the cash actually allowed to be drawn, right? Sometimes they might say access denied. So why do they say that? Over a period of time, right, the bank has actually logged a lot of information about transactions, right? So for example, how many times in the last 1 week have I made a transaction? How much is the amount that I'm asking? So maybe normally I ask for 5,000 rupees. Suddenly I'm asking for 25,000 rupees. That seems a little suspicious, right? Maybe I'm always using ATMs inside IIT Bombay campus. One fine day, you see it getting used in, Gujarat somewhere. Again, that's suspicious. So all of this information goes to that model, right? That has a supervised learning model that has been trained to look at these parameters and say, this looks suspicious, this does not look suspicious. Okay, and then the answer comes back to us. Okay, of course, we're happy once the money comes to us, but I'm just using this to illustrate that it's there in our everyday lives. So on the second, on the right-hand side is the basic premise of online shopping, right? So when you're browsing a web page, suddenly you see an ad, okay? You see an ad for a t-shirt. How did this ad come to you? Over a period of time, right? A lot of data about your browsing habits, right? What you have purchased, what you've not purchased has been collected, okay? And so there is behind the scenes a supervised learning model that has been trained to take your input parameters, maybe your age, gender, your the geographical area where you live, right? What you have browsed in the recent past. They built a model, right? Saying there's a high probability that you will buy a shirt versus there's a low probability that you will buy a computer, let's say, right? And that information is used to promote a shirt to you, right? And then you go and buy it, right? Similar ideas are also used everywhere else in the supply chain. Okay. So the thing that I did not get into too much is what really is the relevance to where you're sitting right now, right? The Navy. I hope you have sort of in the back of your mind been thinking of use cases. Okay. So I'm sure many of the other talks are also covering these. I'm sure you're familiar, but just to think of a couple, right? So one was predictive maintenance itself that we talked about in the early part of the presentation. Right? Maybe it is, some unit that's running inside of a ship, right? And you have data that is being logged, right? And you know that for some time, one particular sensor has been giving slightly outlier values. The model can pick it up, right? And say that, well, go inspect that. There seems to be a problem in that unit, which means before actually the damage happens, you can go and swap it out and do something else. So crucial to this is that a lot of this machinery is instrumented, right? And data comes to you as a database in software, because we are building on the premise that you can do all of this in software in the digital domain. Another application that comes to mind is computer vision, right? So actually, one of the earliest uses of computer vision was, during the Cold War, okay, in the 1950s, when the Russians and Americans were at it, these American aircraft, right, would fly recon missions over Soviet territory or enemy territory and come back with a lot of pictures, right? And the question is, I mean, if you look at a particular picture, you need to be able to say, is this maybe just an agricultural field, or is this a possible site where some I don't know, combat, like missiles are being stored, right? Or some I don't know, bad activities happening, right? So if you get 10 pictures every day, right, you can have a human being looking at them and deciding, well, this is suspicious, this is not suspicious. But if you get 10,000 pictures every day, right, or a million pictures every day, it's just not feasible for human cognition to scale, right? A much better approach is to train an algorithm that will look at a picture and say, this has suspicious activity, this does not have suspicious activity, right? So this is the genesis of a lot of modern computer vision. It has its roots from 50, 60 years back, right? But neural networks, especially having come in, have made this extremely successful, okay? All right, so let me finish up. This is my final slide. Just to put things in perspective, what did we cover, right? We covered supervised learning, which is like a well-known established topic in machine learning. We looked at two families of algorithms for solving the supervised learning problem. One was perceptron, which is like conceptually simple, easy, but a little bit limited in practice. Okay, if you actually have linearly separable data, perceptron is the thing to use. But in practice, data might not be linearly separable. You might not know whether it's linearly separable. So you need to be more generic in your modeling. That is what we do with neural networks, where you can represent very complex things, but you're only guaranteed convergence to a local optimum, okay? Not to the global optimum. You can't sort of have the cake and eat it too, I guess. I want to be very explicit that there is a big ocean of things that we did not cover as a part of this talk, okay? So supervised learning is only one topic. There's also unsupervised learning, reinforcement learning, multi-agent systems, knowledge representation, robotics, natural language processing. So AI is really like huge, okay? It has like 10 or 20 different topics of investigations. Supervised learning is maybe one of them. Of course, it's a very important one, but this is not certainly all of AI. Even within supervised learning, right, there are other algorithms other than neural networks, right? There's decision trees, support vector machines, there's logistic regression, neural nearest neighbors. We didn't get into any of that. We also didn't get into a lot of the practical aspects. There's something called overfitting of the data, right, which you should try and avoid. How much time do these models take to train? How do you come up with informative features? Are these models interpretable? Are they not? There's a lot more to it, right? I chose to go into the mathematical sort of crux. I've sort of left out, say, several other things because we were constrained by the time duration that we have, okay? What I also didn't give you is sort of landscape of tools and technologies that are available to do this. So if you want to apply neural networks, right, you don't have to write back propagation code yourself, okay? There are like five or six very well-oiled libraries that are available. You just download it, upload your data set, and press enter. It'll do the job for you, okay? So again, I wanted to go into the depth, right? So I have left out the sort of easy off-the-shelf way of solving these problems. For anybody who is interested in going into more depth, right, what really do you need to be working in AI, to be actually involved in the algorithm design? So you probably already guessed, you need some knowledge of mathematics. You don't need very complicated stuff. You need relatively basic concepts, but the willingness to be able to apply them, right? Things like vectors and differentiation. You need to be able to program, okay? So, I mean, you're working with a data set, right? Running an algorithm, it's all happening in software, and you have to be able to practically implement this. Last but not least, this is something that is overlooked by a lot of people. You need domain knowledge, okay? It's very unreasonable to expect that you have a data set, right? Sort of an independent computer scientist comes and runs an algorithm and gives you magic back. That's not going to happen, right? It really needs the domain experts and the subject matter experts to work together, right? Because a lot of the modeling, how do you come up with the features, right? The X1, X2, X3, so that it becomes easy for the learning algorithm, you need the domain expertise for that. So it goes without saying that all of you have the domain knowledge, having to do with applications in the Navy. So, I mean, you're really in a great position to directly get into this if you're also willing to do the other aspects, okay? If you can pick up some mathematics and programming, even if there's a small group of you that will do it, right? You'll be in an excellent position for doing it. So with that, I will conclude and thank you very much. I think we do have a few minutes for questions, which I'm happy to take.
Thank you, sir, for
the
talk.
Thank you, sir, for the talk.
Sir, I will close the presentation.
Okay.
Yes. I would like to apprise the audience and before I go for the questions, I would like to apprise the audience and the speaker that Rear Admiral Sanjay Dutt, ACM attendance, was present during this talk. Now, sir, we have a question from Captain Vishnu Mohindra. Sir, you may speak your question, sir. Sir, this audio is clearly not audible. Sir, I request you to type in your question, sir. Sir, we have a question from Captain P.P. Singh. If all the AI algorithms or models are mathematically tractable, that is an approximator which has converged, like you explained, then why are AI solutions not easily explainable?
Okay, great question. So they are mathematically tractable, but why are they not explainable? So the answer to that is, let's look at the picture of the neural network. I mean, I've stopped sharing the slide, but if you remember the neural network, right? It had input, it had one layer of weights passing through another layer of these neurons, another layer. So all that knowledge is captured in those weights, okay? So that is not something that we can sort of look at. If you see a weight of plus 23 here and minus 4 here, do we know what really is the significance of those weights, right? So neural networks in particular have been the fuel for a lot of modern successes. They are not very interpretable, okay, because it's all sort of fuddled up in those numbers. There are other models such as decision trees where it's a lot more easy for us to understand what's going on. But somehow this has been a trade-off. Neural networks have been the most successful model in many modern applications. But their knowledge is all inside of those weights, okay? It's sort of implicitly kept. It's not very easy to translate into a rule or something that a human being can look and sort of understand.
So we have a question from Sri Vivek Srivastav, Scientist T, NMRL in DRDO. So the question is, as we understand, the data quality is one of the most important criteria for efficient AI solutions, especially crucial decision-seeking data sets are not open source and defend due to strategic reasons. Can you share your views about the how operational insights and experience of naval assets by defense personnel can be utilized to improve the quality of defense data for accurate machine learning model development, say by neural networks you just discussed?
Great question. I'll be honest, I don't think I have a very good answer. I mean, the nature of a lot of the data that you have is confidential, right? So I don't know, and maybe there is a case for putting a lot of this expertise in-house, right? If there is a sort of internal team that has the mathematical capability, right, the AI experience, presumably they can do it. You don't have to release it publicly. But again, to be fair, right, like data is very essential. I mean, a lot of modern methods, why are neural networks so good? It's because people have shared their data sets, their experiences. There's the whole open source culture that is sort of fed on itself, right? And created better algorithms. So data is crucial. I don't know if you have to keep it confidential, which you have to, I guess, maybe the best way is to do it in-house. I don't know if there's a better answer. I'm sorry, maybe there is, but I don't know.
I have the audience who raised hand. I have enabled their mic. Left corner, Bikmola, Abhijit, Captain Vishnu Mohindra. If you would like to ask any questions, you may speak by unmuting your mic. Then we have a question from Captain Sanjay Sharma. In machine learning based predictive maintenance module being developed by Navy, there is a paucity of failure data. How do we, like, I've been also working on this kind of project, sir. So the data, like when the machine went down, that kind of data is not, in the present form, we have not recorded. We're already deploying systems as of now to record such data. But presently, such data is not available. So we are actually going for unsupervised learning models. So in such cases, sir, how do we implement a model or a neural network?
Excellent question. Okay. So in the pictures that I drew, right, I was very happily drawing lots of positives here and lots of negatives here. But the reality that is coming out in this question is sometimes there are very few negatives and a lot more positives. Okay, this is true with failure. I mean, machines fail like less than 1% of the time. So you have a lot less negative data. How do you solve it? So there is a sort of separate line of work having to do with what is called class imbalance. Okay, so you have two classes, plus and minus. If the data itself has a big imbalance, they're not 50-50. Suppose they are actually 99-1 or something like that. You sort of artificially reweight the negatives. Okay, you sort of create a whole bunch of negatives, or you just give more importance to the negatives to make it somewhat comparable with the positives before you feed it to the supervised learning algorithm. So that's going to be successful to some extent, but I guess what you are doing with unsupervised learning is sort of an alternative approach for doing the same thing. It's hard to sort of pinpoint the right solution to this without actually knowing the data and actually the characteristics of the problem. Okay, so there are like five or six areas in machine learning. There's something called rare event discovery, which can be brought to bear, but which of these will work? It's an empirical question. It's not something that I think without more details, it's possible to answer correctly.
So I would like to express our sincere gratitude for covering the complicated mathematical, computational and algorithms in a simple and effective manner. The explanation of a supervised learning model with bank loan example was indeed very enlightening. The topics covered during the webinar, such as functioning of a perception and neural network, were very informative, sir. Sir, I have also received a number of requests from student officers who are at Defense Services Staff College, Naval Academy, Naval War College, and Center for Applied Research in Electronics, that they are pursuing some projects in AI and machine learning, sir. So they will be sending their request about some guidance through me to you, sir. I would be glad if you could please guide them, sir. Sir, on behalf of commanding officer Commodore Ajay Patni, I would like to thank you for conducting this session in AI webinar, and we look forward to continue our interaction for knowledge sharing as Center of Data for Big Data. Thank you
very much. I'm certainly open to anybody contacting me. It's really my honor to be helping in any way. Okay, so thank you very much, and do get in touch whenever the need arises. Bye.
It will be an honor for our student officers. Thank you very much, sir.